This is a podcast from policyreview.tv.
We've now got time for questions and comments. We've got some roving mics, but just to remind you, as the mics come round, if you could make sure you stand up and state clearly your name and the institution you come from, because it's interesting, but also our online viewers can know who they're listening to as well. So we'll take questions in sort of rounds of two or three. Who'd like to kick us off? Stunned silence. It's always the way. Yeah, right down at the front. Any others? And then one just behind.
Hello, I'm Linda Moorcroft from AIM Hiring MKOB. It's really, you've touched on a lot of things for us, and particularly going back to your first talk to us, and thinking about collaboration with schools and how we best, particularly with the demise of AIM Hire, really reach those underprivileged children in the disadvantaged schools. I think one of the aspects of AIM Hire that's perhaps worked best has been our targeting, and I just wondered if you'd like to comment on that, how, in the light of the offer agreements, that is being tackled, and how your university would look at targeting of your widening participation activity in the future.
Thank you. And if you could just pass the microphone just behind you. Oh, we've got a second one.
Hello, I'm Alison Siegel from the Widening Participation Team at the London School of Economics, and this is a question for Lord Winston. I'm very, very impressed with your project, and not only the way that it engages young people from disadvantaged schools, but also teachers, and the effect that it has on teachers when they then go back to their schools and take their learnings with them, in terms of the power that research can have and the ability that their students may have that they might not even be aware of. But it occurs to me that the success of your project relies in large part on the willingness of academics and researchers to see that they can actually do this with young students, even primary school students. And I think often academics don't immediately make that link, that they actually could do this. They don't make that link, and they actually don't, for whatever reason, think to take the initiative to develop a project like that. And I'm just wondering if you might suggest some strategies for engaging academics in the kind of project that you've set up, because I can well imagine it happening at the LSE, and I can well imagine it being quite exciting. I think the social sciences is very much an area where, you know, similar projects could be developed, but it would definitely require the enthusiasm and initiative of our academics, and I'm wondering if you could suggest strategies for how to get that underway.
Thank you. Okay, we'll start off with those two. Steve, perhaps you'd like to go first.
Thanks. Okay, AIM Hire disappearing was a bit of a blow. I don't think anybody had quite spotted that it was going to be as fast and as painful. But what we've done in the Southwest, three things really. The first thing was that Universities Southwest, which is the regional organisation that all universities in the Southwest engage with, and at the moment it's still in existence. Hearers around the country are disappearing because the regional infrastructure is going, but we've still got one. And what we're focusing on is a theme around widening participation that might capture the imagination of all of the universities and coordinating them on a geographical basis. So that's one area that we're exploring, and we think that we'll be able to get access to some funding to support that. The second thing that we did as a university was, first of all, talked very quickly to Bristol University, Bath and Bath Spa, which are our immediate neighbours, and pulled them all together and said, look, we've all put in offer agreements, all of which will be supporting investment in fair access and widening participation. But we're all in danger of stripping out infrastructure over the next 12, 18 months until we start to see the monies flowing in. So how about working together to pool our resources to work then with schools in a coordinated way, perhaps a more joined up way than we've done in the past? And I have to say we got sort of a mixed response to that, but certainly Bristol and UWE are now in conversations in particular, which are around, if we're serious about wanting to raise aspiration in the greater Bristol area, city region, then if the two universities work together, what we can open up, working in partnership with our FE colleges, is a huge educational opportunity that would be different for different parts of the geographic region. So let's not worry about whether or not we're an Alliance University or a Russell Group University or whatever we are. Let's just take the Bristol offer and go out and work in schools, regardless of our disciplines, work together to promote access to further education, higher education. And that's got some engagement. If we could get to the point then when, rather than the city league tables that we currently have, which focus in at an institutional level, could we focus in at a regional, sub-regional level and say, what's our collective impact? Because actually the success is not about necessarily UWE going out, working with schools and getting young people into the University of the West of England. It is about getting students into higher education full stop. And if they go to Oxford or Cambridge or wherever they go, that's fantastic, through an intervention that we may have been able to give. So it's thinking differently and trying to break down some of the old walls that were perhaps there. Now, I have to say, the reason that we're probably getting there now is that there is a mutual trust and respect within the universities that we're partnering with, and therefore there's a confidence that perhaps hasn't always been there. So we collaborate on widening participation, we'll collaborate on research, we'll collaborate on academic programmes, which UWE might say, we're not going to do this anymore, but Bristol's going to do it. And there's a much greater, I guess, collaboration. Now, the trick is, could we get others to join that club and that network? And that's slightly slower. So that's a practical set of solutions. And importantly, what we're beginning to do now is to use the work that both universities are doing in academy structures and the trusts to work with those organisations and share, again, resources in there.
Mm. We have a speaker addressing that particular point later this afternoon. Robert, do you want to pick up particularly the second question?
No, the second question, yes. I mean, how do we encourage the academics? It's actually easier than you might imagine at Imperial. I was surprised. My PA put initially, for example, on the intranet at Imperial an advertisement that for a two-day communication course I was going to run for any undergraduate that wanted to come free of charge, which I just funded through a minor bit of purse. And the thing was filled within about an hour and a half. And there were about 300 undergraduates who were disappointed by the end of the day who couldn't get on it. And there is a queue of undergraduates who want to come into the Reach Out Lab, so that actually isn't the problem. PhD student supervisors are not so keen sometimes because they feel they don't want to divert the graduate students. On the other hand, of course, we do have an extremely active transferable skills program now, which is very, very effective, and quite a lot of those kids come into the Reach Out Lab as part of the transferable skills thing. So I think, again, it's a question of how you change the cultural thinking. I was very lucky because, first of all, I set the thing up when Richard Sykes was rector, an extraordinarily forward-thinking man. I mean, it was quite a controversial appointment in some ways, but it was an amazing, amazing vice-chancellor. And the current vice-chancellor is also very, very actively supportive of these sorts of activities, which helps a lot. But, of course, individual faculties will always, in a research university, want to, you know, protect their little patch, and that happens. However, one of the interesting things, and it's interesting about the collaboration, because, of course, to come back on Steve's point, I mean, for example, Bristol has just been brought in as a framework university for EPSIRC. So that's just, in fact, it's just been announced yesterday or the day before. And one of the things, of course, we're doing at the research councils is recognising that the agenda of the government must be, there must be more collaboration with research, that we actually have to open up to some extent. We can't duplicate so much of our capital equipment, which is no longer funded, for example. Now, that's rather a good thing in one way, because actually it has a knock-on effect on how you collaborate in other ways across universities. So I think, although it's not an expected consequence, I think it may be quite useful. There are many other ways I think you can promote this activity with academics. What I did very early on, I don't want to go on at great length, but one of the things I did do was to go to the to the regular lunches that the administrative staff have and say, look, this is what we are starting to think about. And you know, intelligent people suddenly see the value, and it doesn't take quite as much persuasion as one might expect.
Thank you. I think we've got time for another quick round of questions. One right at the front. Any others? Two at the front.
More of a comment than a question.
Okay. That's right. I think we've just about got time. Do you want to go first?
Thank you. I'm Edward Treweller. I'm from Oxford Brookes University. I'd like to repackage my colleague's question here and relaunch it at you, if I may, because I think we didn't quite get to what we were thinking about, I think, in putting that question to you. Okay, I will. we're just launching a collaborative... I mean, fantastic projects, both of you, and sort of stuff that we're doing in our region. We're launching a collaboration between the universities of Oxford Brookes, Bucks New, and Oxford University to carry on the work of AIM Higher insofar as we are able to within our region. We have various sticks and incentives and money, presumably, and you mentioned the sort of gap year, as it were, from our point of view, and we're putting our own funding as three universities into doing that. Mm. The issue arises with the fact that you mentioned that going out and targeting students for quick recruitment gain wasn't a great thing to do, and I would completely support that, but the data that we have from AIM Higher, Milton Keynes, Oxfordshire and Buckinghamshire over the last 7 years is that we've made a big impact by very, very discreet targeting of particular cohorts of students. Yeah. And the difficulty we foresee in this collaborative venture, a new world that we're entering into, is actually working with schools, which is the purpose of this conference. And I wondered if you have any comments to pass on how there might be incentivization from the other end, because from our end, we're all geared up and funded and ready to go and do great stuff with these identified cohorts of kids at the moment, which, in spite of your comments, they are there and they are accessible and can be identified. And I think, really, are there any incentives likely to be forthcoming to enable schools to help us and work towards that end?
Okay, and a brief comment, and then we'll come back to the panel and then break.
I'm Joe. I'm from Lancaster University, Students Union. And my comment was actually on your question about encouraging academics, because we started with student volunteering, and that's what I do. I send students into schools. But we've recently, over the last 3 years, built partnerships with academic departments by encouraging them to allow students to volunteer as part of a module. They are going to schools and taking their subject into schools or bringing schools onto campus and delivering events, and they're gaining academic credit, which is a win-win. They get to volunteer and it's not on top of their studies. It's helping them to gain transferable skills and employability. And a lot of people mentioned competition, and I think anybody that works with children and young people in the room will know that competition is not always a bad thing. And actually, academic departments are under a lot of competition within a university to push employability, gaining transferable skills as part of their course. Mm-hmm. So if you can sell that as part of their course, and a lot of my students say that the reason that they chose their course or even the university is because of the module that allows them to have a more practical approach to learning, going to schools and taking the course in. So it really works. The only one that I am struggling with actually is science, because it's the argument would be, I think, from the department is that. So I'd be interested to know if you had any words that I could take back to my biology and physics departments. Is that with geography, for example, which is a really big success story for us, communicating geography is a very useful skill for any geography postgraduate to have, or geography undergraduate or graduate even, to be able to communicate it. But taking science of the highest level that you learn in higher education, going into a school for half a day a week and being in a science department, while they are gaining transferable skills, the level of science that they're involved with, their argument is that it's detracting from their studies. Same with modern languages as well, because the level of modern languages that they're engaging in is such below what they are. Modern languages have the argument that they already have a year abroad, so I understand that they're gaining transferable skills elsewhere, but science I do struggle with, so that's
okay. We'll come to you, Robert, first. I think Steve's probably got his answer now prepared. Robert, we'll come to you, Robert, first, because I think that's an interesting point, and I guess comes to the heart of what your sort of broader work within the institution is about in terms of communicating science.
Well, I think, you know, one has to recognise that a very large proportion of science students will not be the suitable people to go out in the schools and communicate. Only about a third will. And that is really important. There are some who are not going to get it, yeah. And we have to be very much aware of that. But the ones who do get it, I mean, I think make... I mean, we have schools queuing up because they just want us... They want us in there as scientists. They see that actually we do help them with some of their issues. And, of course, obviously, we have to be sure that we are not working with an agenda which does... other than what fits in with what their needs are for the curriculum and so on. That's, I think, quite important. But I think we can add a dimension. And, I mean, if you looked at my diary and, you know, the letters I get, my problem is actually how we cope with the demand, because the demand is massive, actually, across the country. So I think it's a question of how we do this. I don't want to go on at great length. There was one other thing I just wanted to say very briefly, and I can't remember what it was for a moment, so I'll shut up.
I can always come back to you.
But it was... It'll come back in a second.
OK. Steve.
So this is my second
attempt. Yeah, second attempt, then I'll have to do a referral, full referral. So two things that we're doing, I guess, to try and answer that question. What would encourage schools to engage with us, and how might the funding flows to do that? Well, schools... One of the things that we've done at the UE is we have targeted the worst performing parts of our school system in Bristol, and boy, is there a lot to choose from, because actually Bristol is not great in terms of its primary or secondary performance. Primary is slightly better. So we've gone in and we are working very closely with those schools. And what do we offer them? Well, we offer them board. We put our director of finance, we'll put our senior staff onto their boards, onto their leadership. And that's a huge help to those schools. The second thing that we're doing is encouraging our staff and students to volunteer into those schools. One of the things that schools are desperate for is time and quality people going in and working with them, not necessarily money. And the third bit is in our offer agreement, monies will be able to flow to support specific projects in schools to encourage them to work together. And in Bristol, what we're finding happening is that a lot of the academies and trust schools are now working as collaboratives. They're working together. So they're joined up. Some of them will have a principal, in sort of an oversight principal, who is in charge of all of them. So they're in cluster groups of four or five. And that's quite helpful, because then they're working as a collaborative themselves, which makes our life much easier when we go in and work with them. Does that sort of begin to answer your question?
It sounds pretty similar to what we're doing. I think that the love of it is...
Oh, just wait for the microphone so that people can hear, and then we'll...
Sorry, thank you.
Be brief as well.
I really don't want to dwell on this, because we've got lots of other things to discuss. But the love of it is, yes, we do all that, but because of implants, if you like, or aim higher staff actually in schools with the time that you're talking about to identify the cohorts of potential students from particular polar postcodes or whatever it is to line them up to what we're prepared to do. That's the bit of the jigsaw that's missing, I think, and which we're very concerned about.
But some of the offer agreements might well allow funding of those posts. We wait and see, because every offer agreement, I only know what I've put in. I haven't got a clue what anyone else has put in, but it's those sorts of things that I think we should be smart at doing.
We should wait and see. Robert, it's now come to the other side.
Please now shut up, because I started thinking when I stopped. If you keep your mouth shut, you remember, you know, your brain starts working. One of the issues that we may have, and it's quite an interesting one, which I think would be more likely to be specific to universities like Imperial, is that with the hike in fees and the cost of the sort of education we're giving, clearly, we're going to be more and more selling our wares to China, Japan, and so on. And I think there is an issue about how we change the culture of the university. And I don't know, I mean, I don't know if Sue Starrock's in the audience, is she? I don't know whether Sue has any comment about that. Perhaps she's not here, but she actually is on the programme list. She's from the Royal College of Music, where, of course, we are extremely successful in getting overseas students. The problem, of course, is that when you start to have students who are from outside the EEC, they have a different view of what their education should be, and it's a fundamentally different problem for engaging them in this sort of activity. And it's very interesting. They want to learn to communicate because they think it's going to help them with a job interview, not because it might actually change how people think about the subject. And I think that that is a problem for some of our universities. And it worries me a bit about Imperial, because in fact, the I can't really call them kids, but I mean the students who really are most active in this sort of program tend to be our own European students. Not necessarily British, but in the main they will be.
Okay, well, we have run slightly over time, but I think it was well worth it to have the discussion after two fantastic opening presentations. So if we give Steve and Robert a very warm round of applause for...